don't think it's either or. I think science is great because it's wonderful, and science is great because, amazingly enough, something that's wonderful can have positive impact and outcome.
In this episode of the EMBO podcast, we spoke to neuroscientist Corey Bargman. She's the Torsten and Wiesel Professor and head of the Laboratory of Neurocircuits and Behavior at the Rockefeller University in New York. Her group studies neurobiology using C. elegans as their main model. Dr. Bargman has recently ended her tenure as the first head of science at the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. Running CZI science was not her first experience in the high-level policy and funding sphere. She previously served as co-chairwoman of the Obama administration's Brain Initiative Advisory Commission. Corey Bargman has been an associate EMBO member since 2011. Welcome to the EMBO podcast. Corey is now back to full-time research. We asked her what her lab is currently working on.
You know, here I am. I work on an organism with a completely defined wiring diagram. And in some kind of a perverse way, my lab is focused on the parts of behavior that are not explained by the wiring diagram. And those are the ways that neuromodulators like neuropeptides and small molecules like dopamine and serotonin and adrenaline-related compounds remodel behaviors in real time. So you have a fixed anatomy, and that is, you know, it changes over development, it changes in certain circumstances, but it changes slowly and relatively subtly. Yet you can generate completely different behaviors under different circumstances. And that happens because you have internally generated modulatory states that modify the flow of information through the neural circuits. So we look at internal states that have to do with high activity states and low activity states that are just spontaneously generated internally by the animal. There are other kinds of internal states might be involved with hunger or satiety or with reproductive behavior, where essentially your internal drives, whether cognitive or physiological or emotional, are changing the process of information through these neural circuits. And these systems are very rich, both in humans and in worms. Both humans and worms have about 100 different neuropeptides encoded in their genomes. So these are molecules that people know of, the endorphins that regulate pain sensitivity, oxytocin and vasopressin, which regulate social interactions, neuropeptide F, neuropeptide Y, and related compounds, many of which are involved in feeding type behaviors. And they have sort of recognizably related behavior effects on behavior in different systems. But I think we're really interested in understanding the circuit mechanisms for how those molecules work, how they modify behavior, how they change the rest of the nervous system. The specific example we're looking at a lot right now is the response to pathogenic infection. What happens when the animal gets sick? How does it change its priorities to avoid that circumstance in the future? And just sort of like putting together the different pieces of information from that internal drive and how it modifies not just long-term learning for preferences, but short-term behavior in that environment. You know, when you get sick, you behave very differently. Your energy levels are low. You don't eat a lot, and what you do eat has to have sort of a mild flavor, chicken soup. There's a decrease in sociability. These things are not just your body failing. This is actually your immune system telling your physiology, basically telling your body to protect itself, to not expose itself to danger, and to essentially give itself time to heal before it goes out into the world again.
What I did was discover a mutated gene that triggered an obscure cancer in rats. Afterwards, it was discovered by others that this same gene is also altered in human breast cancers. Corey didn't begin her research career in neuroscience. That was a quote from a 2015 interview she gave to the New York Times, summarizing her work as a graduate student in Robert Weinberg's lab at MIT. You never know in advance where progress will come from. In the Weinberg lab, everyone thought that human oncogenes, not rat oncogenes, would lead to the first human treatments, she wrote in her autobiographical sketch for the Kavli Prize.
You started in the oncology field with Robert Weinberg at MIT, and in a very interesting moment, it looked like an incredibly exciting place to be a PhD student because Tabin and Parada had just done amazing work on RAS as PhD students. And then you as a PhD student cloned something that would eventually become a druggable target in breast cancer, the target for Herceptin. Before we get into that in more detail, I'm curious to know if there was something in that lab or something that it taught you about how you should deal with PhD students or how a lab should nurture PhD students, because these are really incredible accomplishments, sorry, not just your work, but your colleagues. It looked like an amazing place to be a grad student.
I will say that Bob Weinberg's lab was an amazing place to be a graduate student. He is coming up on his 80th birthday now, and he is still running an active research lab trying to address the fundamental questions of cancer that we still don't understand. In retrospect, I can't believe what a good choice I made to join his lab as a graduate student, because he really brought something that I think every scientist should bring to their work, which is a sense of the big picture and the big important questions. He didn't let himself get distracted by details or his particular version of what he wanted to find out. He wanted to see the big picture of cancer elucidated. And he would pull us back sometimes if we got too far down into the details of a particular technique or experiment and say, no, we have a big problem here we're trying to solve. Remember what that is. So that is a great insight to bring your graduate students. The second thing is that Bob is a born professor. He is an educator. He has written textbooks about cancer. He has written for public audiences, and he was always teaching us how to do things. He was always spelling things out and bringing them to us in ways that we could understand and then build from going forward. He was a terrific mentor. It was a very exciting time, but it was also a very challenging time. And we never felt that he was putting pressure on us other than the pressure of the problem itself and what it would take to solve it. He was a great, great mentor. And many of the people from his lab have done really well.
And then in 1986, 1987, when you've successfully cloned a new gene, you then changed fields at a moment. Just to put this in perspective for people, you're about 12 years out from it actually being a successful drug to a successful monoclonal antibody in the clinic. And it's an amazing achievement. And then you suddenly do an about face into a completely new field of science. How did that happen?
I had always been interested in neuroscience, and very much from the point of view of behavior, of sort of the whole way that organisms interact with their environment. And this, I tell the story, my mother used to read from us the work of the early neuroethologists, people like Tim Bergen and Conrad Lorenz, describing the behavior of animals and instincts. And, you know, in the early 1900s, when they were doing this work, they didn't have a way to describe how that would happen. But of course, now we recognize that innate behaviors that are shared by all individuals in a species must have a genetic template. There must be a genetic basis for that. And there was very, very little known about how that might occur. I had thought about that as a graduate student, but I couldn't quite see a path through. And as a postdoc, I started to think about that problem again. I liked the feeling of being in a field very early, before a lot of other people were there. And really, the one group that had made terrific progress studying the genetics of behavior was working in Drosophila. It was Seymour Benzer's lab, which had started studying circadian rhythm and learning in Drosophila, and the people who came out of that lab. And it showed that you could, in fact, identify at a genetic level and ultimately at a molecular level, mechanistic answers to how behaviors were generated and regulated. And this just seemed really fascinating. And so you have to go back in time. You have to go back in time to the late 1980s. There is no genome project. It is still fiendishly difficult to identify even one gene involved in one major biological process like cancer formation. It takes an enormous amount of time. And then when you look at it, you only have literally hundreds of other genes to compare it to figure out what it does. Most of them, when they appear, are baffling lunar landscapes. We were so early in the area of molecular biology at the time. And in that context, It seemed that the right way to go about this was to go about it in a system where you could get to genes and molecules fairly quickly. And the genetic model systems like Drosophila and C. elegans were the ones that had that promise at that time. It took longer to be able to do those sorts of experiments, for example, in mice. Although now you can do those sorts of experiments even in the non-canonical, non-classical model organisms. That wasn't an option at the time. So it was this question of asking if there are instinctive behaviors, if these things exist as genes in the genome, what are those genes? And I should say that when we started, there was even still a fair amount of ambivalence in the field about whether there would be genes that would be able to regulate something as sort of abstract and emergent as a behavior compared to genes that would regulate the expression of other genes or genes that would regulate, you know, ligands and receptors for different molecules. And the existence of the circadian rhythm mutants told you that there really were genes that would have functions that were circumscribed in the nervous system and interpretable, but that wasn't necessarily going to be true of other areas. And so it was worth exploring more broadly and asking what kinds of mechanisms could be responsible for the behaviors that we saw.
And at that particular point in time in 1986, 1987, the wiring diagram of C. elegans was already available, wasn't it?
Yes, the wiring diagram of C. elegans was published in 1986 by John White and his colleagues, where they sliced through an entire C. elegans worm, like a salami, actually a couple of worms, and traced its entire anatomy from its nose to its tail, following each neuron, and importantly, the connections that each neuron made with each other neuron, including both chemical synapses and electrical synapses between those neurons. And so that came out right when I was making the decision about where to go as a postdoc. And the notion that in order to interpret what molecules and genes were doing in behavior, you would be immensely helped by having a map of the nervous system to map those genes onto, and ultimately map their functions with respect to that anatomy, was very compelling. And that was the reason that I chose C. elegans over Drosophila. And I should say that the Drosophila wiring diagram has just become available on a substantial scale in the past year or two. And all of the Drosophila neuroscientists that I know say, I can't believe how much this is changing my perspective on the fly brain and how it works, including neuroscientists who have themselves been using the tools that are available at their highest resolution. So I think we're going to see a big change. I think we're already seeing a big change in how the Drosophila wiring diagram is going to affect research in that field. And I think we're all looking forward to that same change happening as the wiring diagram of vertebrates becomes available, which is starting to happen now. People are starting to work on birds and mice and start to pull together the same kinds of information. So it was that sense of completeness of the wiring diagram that drew me to the worm. I should say there was a wonderful scientist at MIT who had studied with Seymour Benzer. His name was Chip Quinn, and he worked on learning and memory. And I went to talk to him about studying the brain of Drosophila, and I'd seen the wiring diagram. And I said, Chip, how close are we to having a wiring diagram of the fly brain? And Chip said, well, one way you could describe the fly brain is spaghetti and meatballs. It was an incredibly difficult brain anatomically. It didn't even have things like layered neurons that you have in the mammalian cortex to help you orient yourself. Its anatomy is very, very complex. And so it was a challenging issue at that time. And it seemed like a good idea to go around that and be in a system where the anatomy was ready to go.
In 2013, U.S. President Barack Obama announced an ambitious new project, the Human Brain Initiative. Corey Bargman and Stanford's William Newsom were brought in to conceptualize a program to produce what then NIH Director Francis Collins called the Brain Activity Map. Collins was known for steering the Human Genome Project to a successful conclusion with the publication of the first draft of the human genome one decade before President Obama's announcement.
We had this discussion on the podcast last year with Odedra Havi about, well, how do we temper expectations? And the analogy for me sort of with the human genome there was a lot of misplaced expectation when the human genome became available that disease would suddenly be understood. And it's not the case. Pathophysiology does not emerge from the genome fully formed, like Athena from the head of Zeus or something. But of course, it was incredibly useful in many things. And in some discourse, there are some people who seem to have a bit of a notion that once the human wiring diagram, if it is complete, and if it, and it will certainly never be anything as stable as the C. elegans wiring diagram is, that will immediately produce insight into how the brain works. If you take now the comparative of these past decades where you've had this available in C. elegans, and now in the perspective that it is currently available in flies and it will be available in invertebrate models progressively over the next decade or so, what can people expect to understand about the human brain that they don't now once that wiring diagram is available, assuming that it does come out?
You know, I will say that both for studying the human genome and for studying the human brain, if I look at what we learned from the worm genome and the worm brain, I'll say that those pieces of information tell you what's out there, and they also tell you what's not out there. So to give an analogy from the genome, once you have all the genes in the worm genome, you have the material that you need to explain things. You may or may not understand it. Then you go to the human genome. When the human genome was sequenced, there were people who had placed bets on how many genes there were going to be in the genome. And all of the bets were a hugely larger number of genes than actually turned out to be in it. So it turns out that there are, roughly 20,000 genes in the worm genome, roughly 30,000 genes in the human genome. It was a much smaller number than anyone was anticipating. And we were certainly thinking that large complex animals like humans would have a larger genetic component, and it just is not so. And so that you have to look within the genes you have to understand what's going on. It was actually wonderful for both the human genome and the worm or fly or fish or mouse genomes that those numbers were so small, because not only were the numbers small, but the genes were recognizably similar to one another. They were homologous. And therefore, you could move very quickly between understanding that a gene affected the development of the fruit fly in a particular way and quickly look at the human and see that that gene was likely to affect development. Was it in the right time and place? Where was it going to be acting? You could really translate between the animals with incredible speed and efficiency. So the genome was a Rosetta Stone for moving between systems. But it also, it meant that you had to think that the system was solving problems using the parts that it already had available. And in the same way, a wiring diagram constrains the set of answers. You can only get from point A to point B anatomically through certain routes. And you can use that as a starting point to understand what the mechanisms are. And to give an example, I think we're very far from knowing the human wiring diagram. I actually think the wiring diagrams have an abundance of riches, maybe compared to the genomes, which is that I think that there are more connections than we know how to understand. And the problem will be more about how the brain selects among those connections at a given time, or how it weights some more strongly than others as it processes information, rather than reusing the same components in different ways. But I think that's something that we will still understand. I don't think that we understand how the brain works well enough to answer that question now. The value of the wiring diagram is that it gives you a framework to answer those questions. It also gives people a way to work together toward a shared understanding. If you know that you're studying the same brain region and you know other brain regions to which it is interconnected, you're immediately in a position to compare the work that you're doing to the work that others are doing, to see where you can build on each other's work and make progress. And I think that's a very important aspect of what these kinds of shared resources and big projects do, is create common references for people to look at when they're trying to understand what emerges from one lab or from another lab, or from one individual to another individual, or from one organism to another organism. And I think that the value of these resources is tremendous. The value of the periodic table of the elements in chemistry is tremendous. Tells you what's there, tells you what's not there. Everyone has to work around that to make further progress. And that's what these kinds of resources can do for biology at different levels of complexity and at different levels of abstraction or completeness or understanding at this point. But we can kind of draw that analogy through different systems.
There's a quote which shows up in many features about you, which it is, and I quote, "I study the brain of a worm instead of a human being for the same reason that you would want to first study a 1964 Volkswagen Beetle to gain an understanding of how an engine works before you investigate a Boeing 777." and that's a really interesting way to put it. Of course, there are, and that applies to understanding how an engine works, right? But there are going to be things that a Boeing does that a VW bug doesn't do. And what kind of, are there any aspects of mammalian, not even human, but just the mammalian nervous system that you think you can't get at with C. elegans as a model?
I'm going to actually say, I'm going to undermine my own analogy, which is good for talking to a lay audience, but not so good for talking to scientists, by saying that the astonishing thing about evolution that is quite different from engineering is that evolution always has to start from an existing system, and the system has to continue to work, and it can never be taken offline. And for example, going from a propeller plane even to a jet engine, you could not evolve that because it's a completely different technology. You start over again and design the jet engine and replace the propellers, and now you have something new. But if you were trying to do that through evolution, you would not be able to just design something de novo. You would have to start from existing pieces and then maybe modify them. And it's usually simpler to modify something that already exists than to invent something completely new de novo. And that's why DNA polymerase and RNA polymerase and the ribosome look recognizably similar throughout the entire tree of life. Once biology had discovered a way to carry out the central dogma of DNA and RNA and protein, that got preserved with occasional interesting exceptions throughout eukaryotes, prokaryotes, plants, animals, you name it. And so I think that we do have that knowledge of history to work from and the continuity of history that is required for complex nervous systems as well as simple nervous systems. In terms of thinking about different organisms, again, taking an evolutionary point of view, every organism on the planet is a product of the same history. So the number of nematodes on the planet has probably been unchanged for hundreds of millions of years. And yet every nematode can have 300 progeny. So the one progeny that contributes to the next generation is very, very, very good at being a nematode. And the idea of simple and complex organisms may or may not even be a useful way of thinking about them. Each organism becomes extremely skilled at its own abilities. Certain organisms have become very good at chemistry. Other organisms have become very good at other kinds of solving other kinds of problems. Humans are very good at solving problems cognitively and with respect to other animals, we have developed a truly exceptional ability to share our knowledge with one another. And I really think that's the thing that we do that's unusual. The ability to use spoken words to communicate information about what you have learned to someone else is tremendous. It means that our collective knowledge is much, much, much greater than our individual knowledge. I mean, if everyone had to start without language and try to figure out even arithmetic on their own, that would be hopeless, let alone calculus. And so I think that's what our truly unique ability is to drive that kind of shared understanding and learning. That said, I'm quite sure that animals with many, many neurons can solve problems that simple animals cannot. So let's set humans aside, because I really think our special feature is communication and shared knowledge. So let's take a dog or a cat or a mouse and compare that to a worm. I will say that a worm has the ability to solve worm problems with incredible skill, but it is not a generalist. It will not be able to address arbitrary combinations of information and then store that information. And that's, if you think about what a computer with a lot of parallel processing can do, that a computer that doesn't have parallel processing can do, it's the key thing is the more bits of information. And the analogy between a computer and a brain is certainly inexact, but a brain with 86 billion neurons has the potential to store a lot more information than a brain with 302 neurons. There's just a maximum to the combinatorial information that can come out. And I think it's that ability to generalize, to solve lots of general problems rather than just solve the specific examples that you evolved to solve that will characterize the larger brains.
In science communication, it's pretty standard to describe diacetyl as the odorant that gives buttered popcorn its, well, buttery smell. But if you prefer, you can think of it as the byproduct of malolactic fermentation responsible for another buttery quality, the one you may detect in a glass of Chardonnay. While we may not know how worms prefer to think of it, thanks to work from the Bargmann lab, we know how nematodes detect it. In a 1996 Cell paper, Pialis and Gupta, Corey, and their collaborators identified ODR10 and showed that this olfactory receptor triggered a hardwired chemotactic behavior in C. elegans.
With the odorant receptor, with ODR10 and diacetyl and the worms and the buttered popcorn, you have this very hardwired circuit and these beautiful experiments switching receptor expression around and inverting responses. And so you really have this extremely hardwired behavior. And then at another level, you have the kind of very strong imprinting that's in its sense, developmental hardwiring of a learning period, like what you always describe with Conrad Lorenz and Tinberger and so forth. And then you have actual learned behavior where you associate maybe a new smell or an old smell to a new outcome or a new outcome to a new smell and so forth. At the level of how the brain works, how do those processes compare? So what I mean is the hardwired process of positive stimulus and then the brain computing it as a positive score that then says I'll move towards it, and then a positive or a negative learned stimulus, is it a very similar circuit? Does it travel along the same lines? How does learning relate to innate behavior at the level of brain wiring?
There's a gradation, as you imply, between behaviors that are truly innate and behaviors that are learned that go through different intermediates. So animals are born with innate knowledge in their genome about information that has been predictable for very, very long periods of time. So a great example of that is that if your tissues are heated above a certain temperature, they will be damaged. And that information is encoded in your genome, and it allows you to take your hand off a hot stove instantaneously. Recognize that as an aversive stimulus. And in the same way, the Earth has been circling the sun for a very long time, and therefore there are innate pathways for circadian rhythm that reflect the fact that there are different opportunities and different challenges depending on where in that cycle around the sun the Earth is and whether you are nocturnal and diurnal or crepuscular. So that information gets encoded in the genome, and it goes through hardwired systems. And just to kind of contrast that maybe a little bit with, maybe contrast a few sensory systems, even in complex animals, we are not born knowing what we should see. I mean, we are born with the ability to see, in fact, and many animals are born with quite a sophisticated ability to see. Horses can, you know, walk around and run within a few hours of their birth. But we are not born particularly knowing how to recognize faces, how to recognize different objects in the environment. the information, and similarly, the information comes into the retina in a neutral way, activates or inhibits rods and cones, gets processed many, many times, and then reaches the brain in a highly processed form. We are born knowing certain things about the world of smell and taste and the world of touch and things like pain and temperature. So humans are born, infants will reject bitter substances and accept sweet substances. We know which our genomes know which of those substances are likely to promote the survival of that infant. And so there are hardwired pathways, and these are laid down in development by genetics, and they are present in the olfactory or taste systems of every animal and in people. In many animals, there are also similar hardwired pathways that recognize things about other individuals in your species, like whether they're male or female and whether they're in the reproductive cycle or not. That information can also be innately encoded and shared by the individuals in a species. So that's one extreme. Those are the basic pathways that are there for survival, that are highly predictable, so evolution can just encode them and get them there, and then that's done. Then there's a second category, and that's a category of learned events that where specific forms of knowledge are encoded. And a great example of that, which is shared by worms and snails and humans, is called conditioned taste aversion. And in conditioned taste aversion, you eat a substance that has an unusual or unfamiliar flavor. And if you become sick, nauseous soon thereafter, you develop a long-term aversion to that substance. In fact, it can last an entire lifetime. And many of us have had that experience where you ate something that was spoiled and, you know, 20 years later, you still cannot stand the smell of olives because you associate with that experience of having been sick or whatever it happens to be. These are pathways that are semi-hardwired. And there's actually a very interesting history of discovering that form of learning called the Garcia effect, because psychologists didn't believe that there would be this kind of innate learning. They believed that learning was truly general and all purpose. And the scientist who discovered it, his work was really rejected for many years until it was accepted by the field that there could, in fact, be a special conduit for long-term learning associating food with nausea. Again, but that's an evolutionary association. What you eat does affect your visceral sensation afterwards. And so the system hardwires in a special learning system for holding onto that kind of approach. And that, too, that is a system that we still don't understand as well as we should. Actually, a lot of people are getting very interested in nausea right now. So I think within the next 5 years in mammals, that will work out. But I think those kinds of pathways will involve, again, innate hardwired pathways that you can recognize. There will be information from the olfactory system that interconnects with information from the brainstem where nausea is encoded. And those pathways will be strengthened or weakened. Now, the third category, though, is completely arbitrary learning. The third category is, oh, that's my graduate student's voice. Or, no, that's the song of a northern cardinal. And that's a completely arbitrary association between a word, a sound, an individual, my memories of that individual, my visual picture of that bird, however those things are. And that form of learning is the ability, to generalize learning, to connect anything with anything, to generalize, to connect sequences together. That is really something special. It involves uniquely defined parts of the brain in the mammal. That would be the hippocampus, which I think of as like a switchboard, where you have the option of connecting information from almost any part of the brain with information from almost any other part of the brain, that then serves as a transient place to put that information together. In the long term, that information is shipped back out to circuits in other parts of the brain that have that resemble more the innate pathways and having a fixed anatomy. But the fact that the hippocampus is really a flexible part of the brain that encodes information temporarily, that can arbitrarily connect things, and will then ship that information out to essentially clear the slate so that it encodes new things, does seem to be a special form of memory. But, you know, that you can say that that's something completely different. At a circuit level, it is different. But in the long term, it also involves some of the same mechanisms we think are important. The formation of particular connections, the strengthening of some connections, the weakening of other connections. Synapses are the basis of memory, but which synapses and how they are strengthened or weakened, or whether they are pretty much, you know, in the condition that they were laid down by developmental processes, varies as you move between those different forms of learning.
I guess when you put it like that, what sort of jumps out at me is that chemosensory or temperature-based stimuli, they often don't require a level of interpretation, so to speak. So if it's glucose or if it's a noxious chemical or if it's a temperature that's damaging tissue, there's a direct, you could have, and you could have higher order processing, but there is a direct a physiological outcome, both at the cell level and at the organismal level, that connects the stimulus to what happens to the organism, right? You have more fuel, or you have more toxins, or your mitochondria is not working well, or your membranes are falling apart at a certain temperature. So does that imply that at some point in the evolution of the nervous system, there has to arise this, especially for auditory or visual stimuli, there has to emerge this interpretive layer, because then, as you mentioned, there's nothing connecting the sight of something necessarily or the sound of something to the way I should respond to it. All of that has to be learned in those sensory modalities. Or is that not accurate?
No, I mean, we're just as long as we're clear with each other that we are moving beyond well-established scientific fact, but rather presenting a point of view about how the brain could be working and how it could evolve. I'm happy to keep going with you there.
Okay.
Yes, there is an interpretive layer in large complex brains that helps. You can see in the anatomy of animals and of different animals how the sort of interpretive layer for example, areas like the cortex is added on to more ancient layers and more ancient pathways that encode the basic interactions. Anatomically, you can see that happen. Over evolution, you can see that happen. And, you know, an example, you used an example, you said, well, taste is simple, you know, there's sweet is good and bitter is bad. And I use that example, but odors often start as neutral and you develop an attraction to odor or an avoidance of that odor based on your own experience with it. It changes over your lifetime. And humans don't use odors a lot, but there are other animals that use odors to navigate through complex environments, and they know exactly where they are. Nocturnal animals like rodents do a lot of navigation by their sense of smell. And so their processing of that information is probably faster, richer, and more learned, kind of with more information, more in that sort of like level of arbitrary learning than it is in the human brain. We devote that real estate to, for example, learning about faces, learning about visual stimuli. We have these many interpretive layers there.
Corey has previously described her family as frighteningly well-educated and said her parents nurtured her interest in science. She's also often cited the role of the space program in piquing not only her interest in science, but that of an entire generation. I asked Corey if she saw any current topics that had a similar hold on the public's imagination, generating genuine excitement about scientific research.
Well, I would say that coming off of the pandemic, we have had science in the spotlight for the public in ways that has not been before. And as people understand things like how vaccines get developed and how new drugs get developed and how we trace the virus and its changes over time, I think that the kind of person who will be engaged in science is now being exposed to science. And I think that's really important for bringing more people into science. I often hear from people, especially from backgrounds that are not like mine, an academic environment where you would naturally be exposed to that they didn't know anything about science really until they were in college. It was just something that they had to memorize in their classes. And then they were exposed to science as a living form for the first time. And that's what I think the pandemic has done. It's let us see science as a living form and let people see the way that it progresses. I think that the degree of literacy has become a lot higher as well.
It's interesting because that it also then puts it in a context in a way of a great deal of fear and anxiety, as opposed to sort of the more hopeful outlook of the space program, even though that was tied up with the ballistic missile program anxieties about the USSR. But it, in both cases, it really anchors it to very applied concerns, right? And to almost engineering problems or medical problems in some senses. Do you think that's necessary to get the public interested in science?
I think that a certain number of people go into science, particularly biomedical science, because of a desire to do something that will ultimately have a positive impact. The reason that we study things like cancer and neurodegeneration is that we wish to do something about them. And in the same way, studying infectious disease as a way of preventing or solving the problems raised by infectious disease is a worthy and positive reason for people to become interested in science. That said, there's also just the joy and the wonder of science. And I would say the thing that carries that forward most clearly is the area of astrophysics. When you see the pictures coming off the Webb telescope and the amazing images you can see now of the rings around Uranus that you couldn't see before, it really opens people's eyes to wonder. And I think the fact that astrophysics remains just a really exciting area for the public, that these things appear on the general news, shows you that people are willing to be excited, to be thrilled by discovery and by things that they have not known in the past. I don't think it's either or. I think science is great because it's wonderful, and science is great because, amazingly enough, something that's wonderful can have positive impact and outcome.
And now to jump a bit to science policy. So I was listening recently to a podcast you did with Stephen Strogatz, and you said something that really caught my, well, you said many very interesting things, but one thing that really caught my attention in terms of science policy is you were saying that there's a need to move away from problems that can be solved or tackled by individuals and that have individual solutions to things that are tackled by broader teams and that require some more cooperation across science. And if we start from there, so what does that mean? Because then the problem, especially for junior scientists, is what kind of incentives do you put in place so that people can do this and can behave in this way without, let's say, committing career suicide in that?
You know, one of the things that I like about science is that there are many ways to be successful. And there will always be a place for individual scientists doing work, making discoveries, having a great idea, moving it forward in small groups. It's not either or. But at the same time, for certain kinds of complex problems, there is a huge benefit to having a number of people working on the problem and just scaling it up. And just referring back to genetics and genomics, first of all, cloning genes one at a time was really wonderful, and it enabled the identification of lots of interesting molecules. But at some point, it was important to the field that all the genes be identified. And that just took a different kind of scientist. It took a different kind of funding. And it benefited all of the scientists, including the people who still wanted to go and study genes individually based on phenotype. And in the same way, as we in genomics, in human genetics, there was a period at which you could identify a single gene and understand its relationship to a disease like cystic fibrosis or sickle cell anemia. That was very important. But then at some point, it was essential to work in a framework in which you could understand quantitative effects. And that required these genome-wide approaches. And again, suddenly an experiment required 30,000 patients, not two families. And suddenly it required whole genome and very complex molecular analysis and computational analysis of that, not the sorts of things you could do individually. So there are differences that come as you move from sort of the qualitative study of individual systems at high resolution to the more quantitative analysis that comes out of either genetics in particular, but increasingly other areas as well. So I see a few things there. Certainly, I think the value of resources like genome projects, like wiring diagrams. One of the things I've been working on from a funder's perspective recently has been the parts list of cells, the cell atlas. Again, let's have a resource that everyone can use to understand what the different cell types are in the body and know what genes are active in each cell type, and then have that as a framework for, again, you can go back and study a specific model, a specific disease, a specific gene, but with much more information around that that you don't have to generate by yourself. And those projects require, again, they require a different structure. They require a different funding structure. They require people to work together. One of the things that I thought about doing that, and that we also thought about quite a bit with the BRAIN Initiative, is that it was going to be really important to bring computational and analytical scientists, theorists into the mix. And, you know, I think that's now very obvious how much data analysis and how moving beyond bioinformatics to more complex forms of data analysis, to statistical methods, to machine learning are now having a broad effect across biology. But 10 years ago, that was really not clear to people. And those people had a very hard time getting funding because the funders came from backgrounds of experimental science or medical science. They didn't really have an appreciation or an understanding of how to move these fields forward. And also many of the people who had the relevant quantitative knowledge didn't necessarily know what a good biological problem was to put it together, to how to put it together. So I had a multi-paper collaboration with a theorist, with a mathematician named Larry Abbott, who's at Columbia University. And we published a number of papers together. And like, there was really never any problem in terms of assigning credit. It was pretty clear which part was the worm biology done in my lab and which part was the mathematical and theoretical analysis done in Larry's lab. It didn't really matter who was in what position on the authorship, I would say. That's the ideal scenario. It's not always going to be that ideal. I will say that in terms of collaboration, first of all, the funders can encourage it. And so, for example, in the cell atlasing projects, you know, you could set up programs, which the philanthropy I work for, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, did, that required computational people and experimental people to work together. Every team had to include at least one of each. You figure it out. We found lots of people who could do that, and they worked together very successfully. But there's also a second part of that. What you say is, so that's funding. That's one part of keeping your career going. But the other part of keeping your career going is evaluation by your own peers. And I would say we have no one to blame but ourselves if we don't give people credit for collaborating. When we hire them, when we promote them, when we give them our respect and recognition as scientists. And I want to use here an example from physics, which is which is CERN, right? So those are extremely large collaborative projects that involve hundreds of people using these highly technologically developed experimental systems. And in that part of physics, you know, that's how you make progress. And that community has agreed to make sure that people get credit for working collaboratively. So for example, if you know, there might be a paper with, you know, 250 people on it, but if that paper identifies the Higgs boson, that's still, you know, there's plenty of credit to divide by 250 if that's where you want to go. And the leaders of that project, part of their job is to write out, you know, what individuals contributed to those projects and to give credit to those individuals, to send that to their home departments. It's included with their tenure packages when they go out for promotion, is, you know, a letter from the leadership of CERN that says what you did. And everyone in physics recognizes that that letter carries weight and was done in honest and unbiased fashion to give people full credit, and that you don't do that kind of physics by yourself anymore. And I think in biology, I think we're better, a lot better at that than we used to be. But I think, you know, we are the ones who are making these decisions. We have the incredible privilege in academic science of making our own decisions, of making our own judgments about who gets hired, about what we value, and about how our systems are governed and organized. I think that's why, partly as you get more senior, it's one of your jobs to start to take more of a leadership role to keep that process going. We don't have government officials telling us how these decisions should be made. We do get to make them ourselves. And that means that we should also take responsibility for them and make sure that we're making the best decisions we can.
In terms of what you just mentioned, that what we are doing to ourselves, and especially in evaluating colleagues, it's also true of the whole discussion around glamour journals and preprints. And when 99.9% of the time, when you ask someone, why are you someone senior who does not have that many concerns about career progression, why is your lab still sending papers out or to this and that journal? And the answer is invariably because my postdocs or my graduate students need it. So that, to follow what you just said, that's a need we've also imposed on the postdocs and the graduate students, right? So we are doing this to ourselves. Do you see that changing?
You can't do everything at the same time. And there are people who are doing quite a bit of work thinking about what a journal is. The place that I've been really enthusiastic about supporting science is about making information available more freely, whether that's a paper or a data set or a methodology. And so, for example, in the area of publishing, I'm a big supporter of preprints. And that was something, again, that when I was working at the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, we sort of got in very early to make sure that there was a financial basis for those to get started. I think that that idea of sharing your work earlier makes fields progress faster. And I think that was very clear during the COVID pandemic. The fact that things might take a year to come out in a journal would have really slowed down some of the way that that field made progress. And I think that's true in every field. And so I'm excited about that happening earlier. In terms of sharing, I also, you know, I think you mentioned John Sulston earlier. His contribution to the Genome Project was that first he had done the Genome Project of C. elegans, and then he became a very important person in the Human Genome Project. And he insisted that all the data be made freely available, literally like every Saturday night it got published. And that was hard sell at the time. And yet that was unquestionably a major component in the support for the Genome Project and the impact of the Genome Project on science. So I think as much as possible, we should be trying to use those models for large data sets. It's trickier, obviously, when you're talking about human data or patient data, but finding ways of making data sets available for larger purposes is a tremendous way to drive progress. The UK Biobank study of 500,000 patients in the United Kingdom over a long period of time, longitudinally, with genomes, with detailed medical information, is leading to tremendous progress in understanding disease and progression. And to the extent that we can find the ways to do that, I think it's really good for science and good for progress of science for that to happen.
In the case of preprints, I guess one big question that leaves is the role of peer review, right? So EMBO has this Review Commons platform, which is the journal independent peer review of preprints, but still curated so that you have the right reviewers and that you police conflict of interests and you do all the things that editors do, but without necessarily having it attached to a journal, right? Because as you talk to people like Richard Seaver and so on, or just looking online, you see that spontaneous commenting, the sort of post-publication review that was a bit of an idealized version, which is great as an ideal, is actually very hard to come by just because people don't have that much time. Is this something maybe that should be publicly supported? Do you think the peer review structure independent of the journals?
You know, I think what's going on now is that there is a lot of experimentation going on around peer review. And yes, EMBO was early in thinking about some of those experiments. And I think the eLife is now starting another experiment in post-publication peer review. I think it's good to do the experiments. It's good to see what emerges and then to see how that moves forward. I don't have a strong bias going forward about what that will look like. I will say that in terms of misinformation or bad work that came out during the COVID period, the famous journals got at least as much wrong as the preprints got wrong, and probably, you know, to more amplification. So I think we did learn that that process is fallible, which we knew it was fallible, and that the preprint process was a little more solid than we thought because people care about their reputation and about getting things right in science.
I think also with the pandemic, the issue was with preprints, it was said, this is not peer reviewed. And when you make a mistake, like with Surgisphere, just to give it a name, for example, at a couple of major journals, it now has a quality imprint that says maybe to media or someone, you don't need to read this as critically, or you don't need to reach out and interview somebody as you might do with a preprint. So I covered part of the COVID pandemic for Nature Medicine. And there was always this insistence of adding, you know, not yet been reviewed when something had not been reviewed. And there's the implication that if something has been reviewed, it's solid. And that's not necessarily the case. I have one last question, and it's yes or no. Grad School, the movie, will it ever get made?
Thank you for bringing that up. I was glad to be able to think about grad students and like what the graduate student career was like at the time. And I was really happy that it resurfaced again recently on Twitter, and that people still find it useful to think about how graduate school works and, you know, and shared experience as well as individual experience through that process.
If you're a prospective graduate student or a producer looking for a new film idea, look for Corey's Graduate School, The Movie, in Current Biology, 1995. To learn more about Corey Bargman's research, visit her lab page at rockefeller.edu. To know more about EMBO's support for open science and our platform for peer review of preprints, visit the EMBO homepage or reviewcommons.org. Thank you for listening to the EMBO podcast.